This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Glynis Board. This morning is all about health. Like, what's it like to recover from COVID-19?
The physician told me in the hospital that for every day that I was inactive, it takes 3 days to get my muscle back.
That's coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. In the weather across the state this week, partly cloudy with a chance of rabies vaccines. Caitlin Tan has more.
If you look up into the sky, you might see low-flying planes over the mountains distributing brown pellets. It's part of the United States Department of Agriculture's National Rabies Management Program. The pellets are oral vaccinations covered in wax and fish meal, meant to entice raccoons. And don't worry, the pellets are non-toxic to other animals. Rabid raccoons are most common on the East Coast, including West Virginia, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Although there are only 1 to 3 human cases of rabies in the U.S. each year, as many as 60,000 people receive rabies treatment for potential exposure. If rabies is contracted, it's 100% fatal. Joanne Mackey is a veterinarian for Boehringer Ingelheim, the company who makes the edible vaccinations. And she says with the pandemic, more people are outside recreating.
We wish people will be thinking about rabies and that if they see an animal acting strangely in the environment, that comes into their mind.
Planes will be dropping 740,000 vaccines across the state through early September. West Virginia is targeted because the Appalachian Mountains are considered a barrier line for rabid raccoon movement to the west. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Caitlin Tan.
COVID-19 affects people differently. Some have no symptoms or can recover at home, but others have to be hospitalized, sometimes even for months. And this comes at a price for both the patient and the healthcare industry. Eric Douglas reports.
David Sanders spent 2 months at the Charleston Area Medical Center because of COVID-19. He was on a ventilator for half that time.
When I first got off the vent, I still had the trach in, and that was very, very frustrating when I was trying to communicate with friends, family members, and also with the medical staff. I basically had to pass notes back and forth.
He's home now, but he's still recovering. He has physical therapy 4 days a week at home, and a nurse visits him once a week as well. Sanders expects this to continue for 3 months.
The physician told me in the hospital that for every day that I was inactive, it takes 3 days to get my muscle back.
In April, the average cost for a West Virginia COVID inpatient was $21,000 higher than others, according to the West Virginia Hospital Association. The average stay was also 4 days longer than those without COVID. And this is adding up to millions for hospitals, money that not even insurance companies will cover. Sanders is a state employee and has PEIA, a government-backed insurance program. He says his out-of-pocket expenses are about $1,500 and that the insurance paid the rest. But that's not always the case, says Jeff Sandine. He's the executive vice president and chief financial officer at the Charleston Area Medical Center. He says the hospital system was hit twice in the past 6 months. Initially, there was a loss of revenue from reduced visits to the emergency department and from canceling non-emergency surgeries. But now, it's mainly the high cost of treating COVID-19 patients, many of which have government-backed insurance in southern and central West Virginia, Sandine says.
So Medicare, Medicaid, PEIA, you know, we've said this all along, they've always paid less than cost of the care that we provide. And COVID just compounded that because our length of stays are higher, we're using much more resources.
Those resources include staffing at higher rates and stocking up on supplies. Colton Marco is a charge nurse at Ruby Memorial Hospital in Morgantown. He says some days his team is staffed with 16 nurses compared to 12 before COVID. Because of how contagious COVID is, hospital staff have to wear extensive personal protective equipment, Markle says.
We wear a capper, which consists of it's a helmet, circulates the air. On top of that, or with the helmet, it's a shield hooks to it. It filters the air inside this helmet. On top of that, we have to wear a yellow gown. We double glove, and then we have shoe covers that we wear as well.
Even the relatively small numbers of deaths and hospitalizations in West Virginia add up to millions of dollars in expenses for the healthcare and insurance industries. The average charges for the 17 West Virginia COVID patients who died in April was $129,000 each. That's according to the West Virginia Hospital Association. One insurance company, Highmark Health, replied in an email that the company has spent more than $40 million on COVID-19 treatment and care throughout West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Delaware as of June 30th. It's unclear how the financial impacts to hospitals and insurance companies might affect the overall economy. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Eric Douglas in Charleston.
Appalachia Health News is a project made possible with support from the Charleston Area Medical Center and Marshall Health. The coronavirus confronts every aspect of our society, with our healthcare systems front and center in the crosshairs. When hospitals canceled non-essential medical procedures at the beginning of the pandemic, it created an economic freefall. U.S. hospitals have lost $200 billion and laid off nearly a million workers. Urban hospitals and clinics have faced a run on equipment and supplies. While rural facilities have seen fewer COVID-19 cases, they took the same hit to their income and revenue. On the latest episode of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's program, Us and Them, host Trey Kay speaks with healthcare providers all around West Virginia to find out just how healthy is our healthcare system in this age of a pandemic, and which institutions will survive to help redefine the future of medicine. Here's an excerpt.
A few years ago, I met Martha Carter.
I am a certified nurse midwife and was in clinical practice for about 20 years.
She was also the CEO of Family Care, a community-based healthcare system she created in Putnam County 30 years ago to meet the needs of low-income rural women and families. When I visited Carter recently at her very rural home, she was at the backyard pool with her young grandchildren from New York City.
But it's a new experience for them. They're out here in the woods and learning about rural living.
Rural living is part of what's defined Carter's personal and professional life for nearly four decades. She and her husband built this house in the 1980s, right about the same time she started Family Care. It was part of her plan to provide health care for women who were too far away from bigger cities like Charleston. It quickly expanded to treat families. She chose a business model that would work for her patients, nearly all of them uninsured or on Medicaid.
The access to care for low-income women and their families was pretty lacking in this area. As we searched for models that worked, we actually tried a couple different things, but landed on the community health center model, which is just a fantastic model that a lot of people don't know about. It's federally supported. Nonprofit organizations that are locally managed and governed by a board of directors that is a majority of patients of that health center. So there's
who are
a great,
in the community.
Yes, so there's a great tie with the community. The board is very close to the community, knows what the needs are, can help advise the organization to make sure that they're filling the needs of the community. So the community health center model is very effective, and it was a great fit for what we were trying to do.
Carter retired from Family Care in 2019 and is no longer involved with the organization. But she says it did receive some federal stimulus money from the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, also known as the CARES Act.
It was about a two-week chunk of money. Any money is a help, of course, and it staves off closure and having to lay off staff, but I don't know how they're doing. I mean, it must be really tough right now.
Carter is now a consultant and still active in the healthcare industry. She serves on a national board that advises Congress on Medicaid and healthcare programs for low-income children. As Mike Brumage mentioned earlier, telehealth has been a saving grace for health systems that can make it work technically. Martha Carter has long been a proponent for telehealth as a way to serve rural communities. She wants Congress and state Medicaid programs to continue paying for telehealth and make it a permanent option for low-income patients.
A lot of the flexibility that's been put in place through the pandemic stops at the end of the pandemic, at the end of the public health emergency, or in some period of time, 30 days, 60 days, sometimes a couple months. So I'm actually really worried that a lot of the good things that have happened, the things that have really helped increase access in rural communities and disadvantaged communities are going to go away, at least for some period of time and maybe forever after the pandemic or after the public health emergency.
this public health emergency in many ways is something that's kind of bringing attention and maybe holding people's feet to the fire?
Well, we've had to be innovative and flexible and during the pandemic. And I hope we don't just go back to business as usual, because the healthcare system that we had and we still have, but to a lesser degree, isn't really designed for people. It's designed to for the healthcare system. It doesn't really reach a lot of people who need care.
Do you have any idea where we'll land in terms of getting back to a medical system that can tend to general care as opposed to just responding to mostly the COVID pandemic?
My hope is that as we've reported outcomes by race and ethnicity and really realize how badly the pandemic has affected communities of color, that all really sparks changes, not just in the healthcare system, but in our entire culture. I really don't know how this is all going to turn out, of course. I have strong faith in the community health center movement, for sure, because the health centers have always been open to everybody and serve a high proportion of low-income people, communities of color, migrants, immigrants. And so I would love to see the health center model expanded across the country. I think there's a lot of work to be done in the healthcare system to really ensure justice for all. And I'm not sure exactly how that's all going to happen.
The community health centers Carter advocates for are known as federally qualified health centers. They receive government funding and are required to serve everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. In West Virginia, 1 in 4 people gets their care from community health centers. These systems are struggling for economic survival, like all the rest. Increasingly, larger health systems in West Virginia are expanding their footprint into areas with small local regional hospitals and clinics. I asked Carter about that.
Well, we've gone through this cycle a couple of times. There is a good case to be made for care that's integrated so that when care is needed, there's a system past primary care of specialists and hospital care and rehab and residential care. The whole system needs to be well integrated. There's also, of course, a movement to reward healthcare systems for keeping the cost of care down while keeping the quality of care up. So one of the ways that hospital systems can do that, or any system can do that, is by controlling a larger share of the market and sort of vertically and horizontally integrating care. So it's understandable why that's happening. But you've heard me say that I believe so strongly in the community health center model. And so when a hospital system comes into a small town and puts a little clinic there and it's new and people go there, it winds up potentially weakening the community health center in that town and then makes it more difficult for that health center to provide the full range of services for everybody who needs it.
That's an excerpt from the latest episode of our Us and Them show titled Forced Apart, The Delicate and Crazy Dance of American Healthcare. To hear the rest of that show, tune in to West Virginia Public Broadcasting tonight at 8 p.m. There'll be an encore presentation of this episode Saturday at 3 p.m. You can also download Us and Them wherever you get your podcasts or listen online at wvpublic.org. This episode of Us and Them is presented with support from the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation and the West Virginia Humanities Council. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Andrea Billups is our news director. I'm your host and producer, Glynis Board. This is West Virginia Morning.